the MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to the MadTech Podcast, our weekly dive into the world of media, marketing and commerce. I'm Grace Dillon, editor at ExchangeWire, and joining me this week as our very special guest is Dan Calladine, head of media futures at Dentsu. How are you, Dan?
Very well, thank you.
Wonderful to have you. Great you could join us. And also joining me this week is ExchangeWire senior editor Matt Broughton. How are you, Matt?
I'm great. Thanks, Grace. How are you?
Good, thank you. Also delighted to have you with us as we discuss, as we always do, our three topical news stories. Starting with, AVOD revenue growth could outpace SVOD revenue growth in Europe. So revenue from ad-supported video on demand or AVOD services is expected to grow more rapidly than that from their subscription-based or SVOD counterparts in Western Europe. According to analysis from Digital TV Research, AVOD will generate around $16.2 billion by 2028, up $10 billion from $6.6 billion in 2022. SVOD, meanwhile, is forecast to see revenue rise 41% from $17.2 billion to $23.6 billion over the same period. Revenue from content watched via over-the-top or OTT devices is expected to increase 67% to $45 billion by 2028. The UK will account for around $10 billion, or 22%, of total ad spend on OTT viewing over the next 5 years. Germany and France are expected to bring in around $8 billion and $7 billion, respectively, over the same period, according to this analysis. So, lots of figures, lots of different numbers. My first question, really, with this story and this analysis is, what do you think its forecasts or its findings mean for media companies, and how do they compare to other markets? Dan, I'll come to you first on this one.
So this is something which we've been noticing for a while. There were stories that in the States last year, the time spent watching AVOD was overtaking the time spent watching subscription video on demand. And in a way, it's not that surprising. I think when people think about video on demand, they think obviously about things like Netflix and Disney because they've got the biggest budgets, the most famous shows. But actually, when you think about the ad-supported stuff, it's things like broadcast catch-up, it's things like YouTube when you watch it on a TV, and there's lots of dedicated channels. In the UK, we've recently seen the launch of Freevee, which is Amazon's service, and they've got lots and lots of content. And if you have a smart TV, or if you have something like a Roku box, you can get access to these very easily. And so there's more and more of this content. So it's not really surprising. And also what we're seeing is... particularly in the States where the market is more developed, I think more people have smart TVs. But obviously, you know, Europe is catching up. What we're seeing is it's really essential to be buying the ad-funded video on demand to actually get the reach you want for your campaigns, but also to reach some audiences, particularly younger people, because they're more likely to not really watch a great deal of linear TV. I mean, speaking personally, I rarely watch much linear TV, but I watch something like 2 hours a day of things I've either recorded or things I'm watching from streaming services. So on demand anyway. So if you're advertising within those services, then that's going to be the way to reach me or someone like me. But also to say that, it's traditionally been the case that if I spend an hour watching Netflix, that's an hour when I'm not being exposed to any advertising messages. And so the fact that this level is rising is actually very good news for our clients, because it's now potentially easier to reach people as they watch their on-demand content.
Interesting. Matt, what do you make of these findings, and what do you think they mean, and how do they compare?
Yeah, I agree with Dan. Obviously, SVOD and AVOD are growing, but AVOD is growing at a much faster rate. I think looking at these figures in particular, the 4% compound annual growth rate of SVOD from 2023 to 2028, I think that's likely to scare a lot of streaming executives in the SVOD space, because obviously we've got the sort of multiple issues of subscription saturation. We've got high inflation at the moment. That's reducing spending power, particularly among those younger audiences, as Dan says. And obviously, for these SVOD services, growth outside of the US is critical. So for them to see a 4% growth in key markets such as Western Europe, I think that's where obviously we've seen the likes of Netflix going heavily into AVOD services simply to recoup that that reach. And I think there is a huge opportunity for AVOD services in Western Europe, and kind of building again on Dan's point in terms of the broadcasters. I think they're doing very exciting things with their data. Obviously, we've got the likes of ITVX and All4 in the UK, for example. And yeah, they're just doing incredibly exciting things with their data. They're going to do well in these times where people are looking more for either free or cheaper services to watch content. So yeah, it's a really exciting space, and I think there's going to be lots of media buying opportunities arising as a result of that.
But I think also as a viewer, it's getting to be so confusing that you hear about, you know, almost every week there's a different hot show that you've got to watch, whether it be Succession or whether it be, you know, one of the ones on Apple, you know, Ted Lasso a couple of weeks ago and things like that. So it's getting to be really confusing as to what sort of things you need to subscribe to. So to be honest, if it goes more towards AVOD, that's potentially better for consumers, because it's like, you know, regular TV, you just change channel from one to the other. You've got access to everything, but you just change channel from one thing to other. Although obviously with things like Netflix, it's not free, but it's a reduced subscription for the ad-funded version.
I mean, looking at these, this particular analysis indicates that subscription video on demand revenues will still be higher, even though they'll grow more slowly over the period. How does this kind of compare to other markets or other regions in terms of appetite for advertising supported and therefore like a cheaper option? Is Western Europe just, I guess, more or maybe less convinced by advertising supported? And like, how does that compare to like APAC or the Americas?
So I think the top markets are, I think, the States and then China, and then the UK comes third. And then no other European market is within the top five. But I think what's likely is that it correlates quite strongly with the level of digital ad spend. So I think if you're buying digital video advertising, then it's, you know, then you're more likely to be buying advertising within AVOD services, because it's really just another way of, you know, it's another place for your digital advertising to go. So there's a strong correlation. So the UK is leading in terms of absolute spend, with other markets following behind. But I think the thing to really remember is, you know, it will correlate very strongly with total digital ad spend, which again shows the UK very strong leader within Europe, but then quite a few others, you know, a little bit behind.
Interesting. Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, I think in terms of, you know, looking at the APAC region in particular, there is a lot of sort of high performing regional players in terms of the AVOD space. You know, you've got the likes of Vue, iFlix, WeTV, MeWatch. And I think it obviously shows there's appetite for lots of these players within that market, where there is obviously a high level of a high audience for OTT content. Whether we'll see the same level of proliferations in terms of players in Western Europe, maybe not. But at the same time, I think coming back to my earlier point, it shows that there definitely is appetite for these AVOD services, and it's going to be a high period of growth for these. And again, I think the national broadcasters, they can do very well out of this with their BVOD services.
And touching on, we've mentioned Netflix as a big player who for a long time resisted kind of moving into an AVOD service and eventually did a U-turn. It hasn't got off to the best of starts, it seems. How do you think their ad offering will unfold? Do you think it's just having teething issues and it will really kind of take hold going forward?
I would assume that they will get it to work. You know, I mean, as a company, Netflix is all about test and learn. And so I would assume they will, you know, find ways to speed it up. The other thing which I think is really interesting is that they've put a lot of emphasis into things like measurement. So they're on Barb in the UK. They've also done deals with people like Double Verify, people like IAS, to actually, you know, see that the advertising is appearing, see that the advertising is viewable, and things like that. So, so I think these are really important steps that agencies and clients need to actually start to give, you know, the same sort of level of information from a connected TV buy as you would get from another sort of digital video buy. So I think that's it's really important that they did those things. I assume it will work eventually, but I think as with a lot of these companies, it's quite hard to actually know the official figures. What I would imagine is, I think their next quarterly results come at the end of April. I think they will make some sort of statement at that point, and they may even have things like case studies of how things work.
And Matt, what do you think? What do you think's in store for Netflix's ad offering?
Yeah, I think it's very early days for them, and I agree that they're going to be doing a lot of testing. I think they're going to be gradually rolling out features and additions to that ad platform. Obviously, yes, there's been stories of them both in Europe and in Australia, for example, of them, you know, refunding marketers. But again, I think that's just as a case of teething issues. I don't think it's a you know, alarm bell should be ringing there. Obviously, they're going through the process of building this platform up, and I think they have gone the correct way about it, as Dan says, in making sure that there's as robust measurement standards within that platform as possible.
Great stuff. I mean, yeah, we'll have to wait and see, and I'm sure we'll be talking a lot more about AVOD versus FOG going forward. But I'll move us on to our second story of the week, which is that chatbot inaccuracies spur misinformation fears. The launch of chatbots has been the cause of much excitement in recent months, but some worry that these technologies' tendency to make mistakes could have far-reaching consequences. OpenAI's ChatGPT, which has been incorporated into Microsoft's Bing search engine, and Google's follow-up effort, Bard, have both been spotted providing inaccurate responses to users. One such example is ChatGPT incorrectly stating that its rival had been shut down, citing a joke comment on a news article and a fake news write-up as evidence. The above instance indicates chatbot's incapacity to discern reliable sources and determine what information is factual. The Verge's James Vincent argues that this demonstrates the potential for AI language models to be used to spread misinformation online, and that added disclaimers about the accuracy of these chatbots may not be enough to prevent such an outcome. We've seen After kind of drafting this briefing, though, we've seen an open letter emerge signed by a number of big figures within tech and AI, Steve Wozniak, Elon Musk, numerous people. It's got well over 1,000 signatures, basically calling for a pause in AI development because of these issues and these potential dangers relating to misinformation. I think my first kind of question, with that in mind, and thinking about the example cited here, is, have we potentially underestimated the potential harm of chatbots? What do you think, Matt?
Obviously, it's a very embarrassing case for ChatGPT and Google Bard, and it does demonstrate definitely that there needs to be more robust training standards for these machine learning systems and a more thorough citation of sources. But it's important to remember that these are very new platforms. They're kind of in a very early sort of beta stage, and you know, in theory, I don't think it should necessarily be that challenging to assign a trust ranking to specific publishers within data, and also separating out main page content versus content within, for example, comments, which is how this particular case arose. But I think we definitely need to avoid mistakes that have taken place in fields such as search and contextual, and ensure that publishers are involved with the process, and more importantly, they're appropriately credited or remunerated even for their content. I don't think the potential harm of chatbots has been underestimated, at least in terms of misinformation, as I don't think that generative AI, maybe this is just a personal opinion, but I don't think it's likely to be used by users as a primary news source. So, for example, in this story, we only really found out about it through Twitter, which is a massive social media network, and then The Verge, which is a well-read publication. And I think where generative AI will be used by publishers, there will be further checks and balances. And also think, even flipping it on its head, these kind of systems could be used to combat misinformation, particularly in non-English speaking countries. When we had the Facebook leaks by Frances Hogan, she said that 87% of spend by Meta to combat misinformation was directed directed towards the English language, where only something like 9% of users were English speaking. So I think to be able to use these platforms, which obviously are more capable of disseminating non-English language content, that could be used to combat misinformation.
That's really interesting. Dan, what do you make of the story in itself, and also what Matt has just touched on there?
Yeah, I think we need to be really careful about how we use tools like this. I think in the 3 months or 4 months or so since we've had ChatGPT 3.5 and people have been experimenting with it and playing with it, I think we've just sort of been diving in without really considering, you know, that maybe we're being a bit too enthusiastic about it. But, you know, the point is, the first time you use it, it's absolutely magical. When you ask it to do something, and rather than just returning a search query, you know, it can do quite complex things in terms of, you know, writing you poetry or translating, you know, writing you a letter or something like that. So I think, you know, I think we've sort of jumped into it without necessarily considering that we're being watched by it all the time. There was a story last week about some of the data from ChatGPT being sort of shared with other people. So almost like your query history being searched with other people. There was also a story about some malicious actors who made a Chrome extension for ChatGPT or something else that if you added it to your browser and used it for other things, then it was potentially taking data from you. So I think when anything is really new, people are quite likely to just sort of jump into it and enjoy it without really considering, you know, maybe what they're doing is going to be, is going to be shared with other people that they won't do, or maybe it's opening up their machines to other sorts of vulnerabilities. I really don't know enough to comment on the piece about pausing advancement for 6 months. I mean, I think as far as I'm concerned, even if it stays as it is at the moment, more and more people are going to be finding more and more things to do with it and integrating it into their own apps. We saw the launch of the plugins last week where people like Expedia, people like OpenTable, and people like Instacart, I think, you know, effectively had versions or effectively within ChatGPT, you could be searching through their own live databases. So you could ask it about a trip and it would find you flights and it would find you hotels and it would find you things to do. And then you could just book them using live data from people like Expedia. And I think that sort of thing is going to continue even if development in the actual AI systems is halted for 6 months. But I also think, I was looking at this story today, and I think you could disappear down an absolute rabbit hole by trying to work out where you stood on whether it should be paused for 6 months or not. And I'm definitely happy to let people with much greater understanding of the area look into that rather than me.
I think you're right in the sense that, you know, the toothpaste is at least to an extent out of the tube, and it's going to be very difficult to, you know, reel back whether there is a pause implemented. We've discussed previously on the podcast, and not just us, a lot of people have been kind of considering how these chatbots or generative AI may affect search and search advertising as a result. Do you think that as more of these stories emerge about inaccuracies, and as you've talked about, Dan, about, data misuse potentially, or data scraping, do you think that's going to discourage brands from kind of exploring, or advertising technology companies from kind of exploring how search can be kind of enhanced maybe by chatbots?
I don't think it'll stop them exploring. I think everybody's doing a lot of testing at the moment, whether it's trying to work out how the Bing integration with ChatGPT is actually surfacing answers, how it's actually, you know, what sort of what you would have to do to a page to get your content included in some of the answers that it asks, you know, for example, again, about things like travel itineraries, how you actually get your content into there, because all of those bits are sourced and you can click through to the site to find out more information. So I think there's going to be a huge amount of experimentation. I'm not sure that people can use it all that directly in terms of things like search marketing at the moment. But I do know that a lot of people are trying to use it to do things like, you know, an easier way of finding big keyword lists of things they can buy on, but also things like, you know, potentially reporting. So here are some numbers, please write a report about around these numbers. And I know that people are doing those sorts of things at the moment, or at least experimenting with them.
Yeah, I suppose as well, there's always the element of a fear of missing out. So even, you know, with these, hurdles, shall we say, or trickier elements, they may not be enough necessarily to just put people off from touching it, you know, completely or going anywhere near it.
I think you should definitely experiment with it. I mean, I try to sort of play with it for about, 5 to 10 minutes a day or so, or longer, just to get into the habit. So look, you know, trying to see some of the searches I've done, how they would work within some of these things. And also, you know, trying to see what pictures I can create, trying to see how I can change the order of words to see how the picture changes and things like that. So it's definitely the sort of thing that people should be experimenting with. But I mean, but again, you know, sort of caveat emptor and things like that. Don't take anything you get out of it as absolute gospel truth. I was staying somewhere a couple of months ago, and I put into ChatGPT, you know, what are 3 days, how I'm spending 3 days here, how would I use the time? And it did things like, you know, recommend a farmer's market that closed 2 years ago and things like that. So you need to, you need to do your due diligence when you're using it.
Do you think that the disclaimers that have been kind of added on, like Google's added one onto Bard, kind of just saying, oh, you know, it's new, it can be liable to making mistakes. Do you think that's enough to, remove liability to an extent? Or do you think really the tech companies who are kind of supplying this technology need to be a bit more thorough in maybe their measures?
I mean, I think if people want to get bad things out of it, they'll get bad things out of it. And I've seen examples of guardrails being put in place in terms of you're not allowed to ask construct an argument in favor of XYZ and stuff. It won't do that because they don't want it to do that. And they also don't want screen grabs of that all over the web and things like that. So I think there are some guardrails, but you know, I would hope that the people sort of trying to make mischief with it don't mean that it becomes unusable for people, you know, genuinely trying to explore, genuinely curious, trying to work out how they can use this technology.
Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think it comes back to how they're training up their data sets and as Dan says, putting those guardrails in place. And I think how it's going to be used, like I said, I don't think it's going to be people put in a prompt and then just automatically read that as a source of truth. I think there will be, especially if you're, you know, researching something, or especially, like I said, in terms of news, I don't think people will be like going to ChatGPT for the headlines and reading all the analysis. They're going to go to more trusted publishers. But yeah, in terms of how those prompts are used and created, I agree with Dan in the sense that there should be those checks and balances in place to make sure malicious actors cannot just, you know, kind of ruin those data sets. But I'm sure that's something they're working on in terms of how to train that data and how it's, you know, presented to the end user.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, we'll hope so. And hopefully that's what we'll see going forward. And we'll see what happens with this this open letter, whether it actually has an impact and developments pause. It'd be really, really fascinating to see what the response is to that. But I will move us on to our last story of the week, which is that significant job cuts at Meta have been taken by some as proof of the metaverse's demise. However, this isn't the case, argues Doug Griffin, who points out that this conclusion incorrectly conflates the company with the virtual space. Griffin also asserts that the tendency to overestimate the value of new technology in the short run and to underestimate it over the long term could well apply to the future of the metaverse. Considering the expansion of the internet and enhancement of mobile technologies, the landscape is ripe for metaverse development, and the space's success is more dependent on consumer interest than on infrastructure, says Griffin. With virtual spaces already off the ground and expected to grow, the future of the metaverse appears more assured than critics claim. So, interesting, again, an interesting point of view. We've seen a few people kind of express a kind of waning enthusiasm towards the metaverse recently, over recent months. We've seen Microsoft close their industrial metaverse team after 4 months of operation. Disney have also shuttered their metaverse division after just over a year. So it seems like a bit of a maybe a less enthusiastic, shall we say, reception to the metaverse at the moment. But what do you think, Dan? Do you agree with Griffin's analysis here? Do you think that the metaverse is still a big part of the future, or do you think maybe it is on the decline?
I think it's classic Gartner hype cycle stuff, really. I think, you know, people get very excited about things, particularly in places like agencies. And then you get this sort of this trough of disillusionment, and then slowly it starts, you know, sort of creeping up, and people becomes more usable. People develop more things. I think we've underestimated, and you know, I'll put my hands up as being somebody who's probably been over enthusiastic about things like the metaverse in the past. But I think the point is that it will happen at some point, but it won't happen, you know, in the next couple of years or next 5 years or maybe longer. But I think the point is, so there's three really important things. The first one is that the technology is getting better all the time. So the phone I buy this year will be better than the phone I bought 2 years ago. It'll be faster. It'll have faster processing and things. So it will be able to, do more things around, you know, potentially 3D virtual worlds and those sorts of areas. The second thing is that younger people are just very used to living in virtual spaces. They're not just digital native. They're sort of, you know, game native, immersive world native. And then the third thing is, if you combine those two things together, and then you start to get people who grew up playing Fortnite or Roblox, and then they get, and then they start to create themselves, and they get access to the technology, but they think in a completely different way, in the same way that, you know, the first generation of people with smartphones, that was always what a phone was to them. And when they started creating apps and when they started creating things to do, then suddenly, you know, there were big leaps forward. So I do think it will happen. I don't think it will happen as soon as we thought it would, if we'd been talking a year ago or a couple of years ago or something. But I don't think it's one of those things that you can, you know, that you can completely write off. It's one of those things where I think something like, you know, something like having a spotter network, or something like keeping your ear to the ground, or just knowing a very diverse group of people, is really useful for these sorts of technologies, because stuff will be happening under the surface. Stuff will be bubbling up. You know, people like Roblox will always be developing new things. There'll be new games coming along. And so I think, you know, it depends where we are at the moment on the hype cycle, and that's obviously very up for debate. But there will be a point when it starts to tip up again, and then it will accelerate going upwards, and we'll wonder why we thought the metaverse was a crazy idea. But we just don't know when that's going to be.
Matt, what do you think? Do you agree with Griffin's analysis and Dan's analysis here, or do you think perhaps we've kind of come to the point where the metaverse isn't quite as viable as we thought?
No, I do agree. Especially agree with Griffin's part of the argument that Meta does not equal the metaverse. I think, obviously, you know, Facebook and other Web2 giants, they operate on that very kind of closed model with very limited interoperability. Obviously, we've seen the likes of recent market movements by Apple, for example, to try and consolidate power within their app system. And I think the kind of current Meta vision of the metaverse as a Ready Player One vomit inducing headset wearing, you know, dystopia will not be the future of the metaverse. I agree with Dan that we're kind of at the end of the current hype cycle, what I kind of think is the current Web 3.01 cycle, where we've seen, you know, the collapse of crypto banks, although it's also important to remember, you know, more traditional financial institutions are also going through strain at the moment. Obviously, you know, we're not seeing as much hype around things like NFTs. at the moment. So, and there's been, I think most importantly, the shift of investor attention away from Web3 towards things like generative AI. And I think that just gives much more breathing room and flexibility for Web3 solutions with more kind of provable use cases. It gives that more room for development there, including obviously metaverse environments. It allows them to grow a bit more organically and allows them to be a bit more sustainable rather than, wow, look, we've, you know, launched this thing, massive hype, and it doesn't actually have the kind of usability that it needs. And I think importantly, bringing it to media buyers, there's still strong interest from brands engaging in the sector to kind of tease some research we're launching in the coming months. There's, you know, still a very high appetite for Web3 solutions. And for example, in the last couple of days, we've seen Tommy Hilfiger launch a multi-metaverse activation across platforms such as Roblox and Decentraland. And I think for me, that's hugely exciting as it proves that kind of interoperability between different metaverse environments, which has been personally one of my main criticisms of it. It's just like, you know, how can you call yourself a metaverse when you're still quite a closed platform? But now a brand has gone, right, we're launched a centralized hub where people can just go into all these other metaverse environments. And to me, that seems much more like what a metaverse should be. So it's hugely exciting to see a brand do that and be involved in that. And I think those kind of use cases going forward proves that this isn't the end of the metaverse by any extent. And as Dan said, it may not be as quickly as we first thought, but there's definitely still development going on it, and there's still definitely so many exciting use cases for it. And I'm looking forward to seeing how it grows and develops going forward.
I mean, thinking about one of the, I suppose maybe key issues with the metaverse is a kind of lack of a clear definition, or maybe like a standardized view of what it actually is. I mean, there's even debate over, you know, the metaverse versus a metaverse. Is it just going to be one centralized expanse, or are we going to have lots of different ones? Do you think that kind of, for lack of a better word, vagueness, or maybe lack of a definitive description, do you think that has fed into kind of maybe this drop in interest or drop in confidence? Or do you think it actually is beneficial in that it kind of opens the concept up and the space up to development? It kind of gives it less of it's less confining to the development of it.
I don't think it helps that people find it really hard to define the metaverse notion. I did write something down, but again, I wouldn't, you know, I've read books where they define it and other books where they define it in different ways and things like that. So I think as a concept, it doesn't help that you can't, you know, clearly picture exactly what you think it is, or you can't necessarily say whether something is a metaverse or something is just a multiverse and things like that. So yeah, I don't think it helps in the overall selling of the concept to people. But I do think that there are still lots of people who are very into the idea. And, you know, Matt was talking about NFTs, and I think NFTs are, you know, I think it's rightly seen that the world went a little bit mad a couple of years ago with NFTs and Bored Ape and things like that. But I also think that there seem to be some organizations that are making NFTs work well for them, including things like sportswear brands like Nike and Adidas. And it may just be that with some parts of the audience, these things totally work. They're very, very suitable. They're very tuned to what some of these people want. I think the other thing is that most people's definition of the metaverse is that it does involve elements of virtual reality. It does involve elements of 3D. And one problem versus, for example, generative AI is that you need to spend quite a lot of money on equipment for it. Whereas with generative AI, you can use your existing laptop, your existing phone, you can just get access to it. And so that's why that can grow really, really quickly. There's, you know, people didn't need to make special hardware for you to actually use it, and you didn't need to have to go out and buy it. So, and I think at the moment with cost of living, energy prices, inflation, everything else, I think it's, you know, I think sales of things like VR headsets are going to be comparatively low, just because there's more, there's other things to spend money on.
Matt, what do you think? Do you think that this lack of a standard definition is harmful to the metaverse's success or development, or do you think it maybe does give it a bit more freedom?
Yeah, I think it's been harder for people to engage with it where there has been so many different definitions of it. And, touching on my earlier point, I think now the kind of cool down in hype around it, I think that will just give the industry and give the market a bit more space to, come to more consistent standards there. Obviously, for example, using the gaming industry for an example, there was a huge spike of companies bringing out blockchain-based games and, promising lots in terms of, vibrant in-game economies. And then they kind of actually forgot to make an interesting game off the back of it. They just had these kind of in-game economies and not the kind of interest in using that. And touching upon Dan's point in terms of the NFTs, obviously, sending a little picture, that's not going to be as promising use case as, for example, Nike and Adidas in terms of having a bit more, tangible, collectible value. And which is why we've seen, I think, a lot of success, particularly in terms of the luxury brands engaging with NFTs. So I think in terms of the definitions, they will come. Obviously, it has been vague so far, and I think that has harmed adoption to some extent. But I think now where we're going to see the more kind of provable use cases, things will settle down and realize, actually, no, this isn't useful in terms of a metaverse perspective, but this actually is. This is how a brand is using it and gaining success from it. Then I think that, the interest will naturally return as a result of that.
Interesting. I mean, again, so much more we could discuss on the metaverse, and I'm sure it will come up numerous times again in further discussions, but we'll leave our discussion of the metaverse and the news of the week there. And we'll move on to the second part of the podcast, where we talk to you more, Dan, about what you're working on at the minute at Dentsu and what's interesting you most. So tell us a bit about what's been going on at Dentsu and what you've been working on there.
So my role these days really involves a lot of thought leadership, creating reports, answering difficult questions, those sorts of things. So I get pulled into quite a lot of things like pitches, where somebody might have a question about, what is so-and-so going to be like in 5 years' time, or what is the future of such and such. So I've done quite a bit of answering questions like that, but then also working on reports around things like trends and other sorts of thought leadership around, potentially things like ChatGPT, potentially things like connected TV and those sorts of issues. So my role is sort of largely around things like content creation, but that also involves a lot of really trying to read around the subject, really trying to understand something, what it means, but then also talking to the agency, to the experts within the agency, to say, what are you working on at the moment and how, what is your perception of such and such? Because I suppose if you think about something like advertising on Netflix, it's quite easy to get caught up in the hype of it, but then when you speak to people on the ground, they, and they actually are buying things like connected TV campaigns all the time, then they can sort of see it in much more, in much different eyes. So it involves a lot of really trying to work out what's happening, but then also trying to make sure that, we have very solid points of view on everything.
And what kinds of areas have your clients been kind of most interested in or curious about?
Well, it is things like AI. So I did a presentation this week to one of our clients, really just showing some examples of AI. And as like we've been discussing in this call, talking about, this is what it is, this is what it isn't. Here are some examples of brands doing some quite interesting things around it, whether it be creating text or creating pictures. So AI is definitely one of them. And then, connected TVs, another one. But also things around, just the different ways that we can trade media, the different sorts of things that are evolving within the whole media landscape. And that could include, things like audio and also things like the merging in platforms in terms of, newspapers now all have audio product in terms of podcasts and things like that? And what does this actually mean if you're, you know, if you're buying across a title, what can you actually get? And then I suppose another area is just about how advertising works, because we've always had a strong interest in things like the attention economy. So things like how much attention do people pay to the advertising that they see? So going beyond buying impressions to whether these impressions are visible, to actually trying to work out what is attracting people's attention, what is it about this particular ad or this particular placement which is generating high attention. And then I think another area that we're super interested in is all about the idea of sustainability, so sustainable media. And this involves things like carbon footprint of campaigns. But what we're actually now doing is linking this through to things like attention. And we launched something a couple of weeks ago where we're really trying to look at how you can make your advertising more sustainable and more effective at the same time by looking to see what placements, what creative gets the most attention, and then trying to see if you can, you know, focus on that sort of thing and actually buy less media, but be more effective, but also be producing sustainable campaigns.
Yeah, definitely a really, really important cause and a massive topic that we've seen a lot of discussion about, and a lot of agencies and players across the industry are very, very interested in being involved in and working on. Are there any areas you think that you know, the industry should be paying particular attention to? And I mean, do you think that the areas you've discussed will continue to be important going through as the year progresses?
Oh, totally. Yeah, I think these are very long term. These are very long term things, but you know, both in terms of how advertising works. So, really, just the efficiency of the marketing and making things better value for what clients are, how clients are spending their money, but then also just being very aware of the role we play in society. I think if you're involved in the media, then you're potentially involved in how people think, changing people's minds and all those sorts of things. And you really need to use that for good.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, as we've discussed here, misinformation is unfortunately a bigger issue than we'd all like it to be on online. And so I think that awareness is incredibly important. A final question for you is, what are you most interested in personally, and what kinds of areas are exciting you most, kind of looking back on the year we've had so far and kind of looking ahead?
I think it is things like AI, because I'm experimenting with it. I'm playing with it. I've not yet managed to get it to write particularly good, you know, paragraphs or sort of longer than paragraphs. I've seen examples where other people have asked AI to rewrite things for them, or to say, you know, can you rewrite this, but in a passive voice or in an active voice or something? So, you know, how AI can actually boost productivity, but also trying to work out, you know, the sort of things that maybe nobody's thought to ask it and what it might do in those sorts of ways. So how we can actually not only do things like, you know, do things better, do things more productively, but also, you know, potentially do things for the first time just by asking questions that nobody else has thought of asking.
Brilliant. I mean, that's something I've never actually given these generative AI systems a go. So maybe that's something I should try and incorporate into my day to day. Brilliant.
I'm shocked.
Are you shocked? Yeah. I mean, I know other members of the team have had a go with it, but I've resisted. I'm not scared of the machines, but I have resisted so far. Well, thank you so much, Dan, for telling us more about your work at Dentsu and discussing the new stories. It was great to have you.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Matt, for your insight as always. Great to have you as well.
Thanks, Grace. Pleasure to be involved.
Wonderful. And thank you, everyone, for listening. That was this week's MadTech Podcast.